often when we think about martyrs, it's tempting to think that we're dealing with the distant past. But it's key for us not to forget that the 20th century produced more Christian martyrs than all previous 19 centuries combined. Our next talk is about two parish priests who were martyred in the last three decades, in all of our lifetimes. In the midst of their ordinary pastoral work, as good shepherds willing to sacrifice themselves for the good of their sheep. Father Jerzy Popiełuszko was a parochial vicar in Warsaw sent by his pastor to care for the striking workers and union members of the Solidarity Movement in the Polish capital. His sermons began to be broadcast by Radio Free Europe, and the Polish intelligence agency tried repeatedly to silence and intimidate him, but failed. After he escaped a car accident manufactured to kill him, he was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered by three secret security police officers, and his body was dumped in the Vistula water reservoir. A quarter of a million people attended his 1984 funeral. It's powerful to remember that if he had not been assassinated for being a good priest, he would only be 66 today and still working in the vineyard. He was beatified in 2010, and a miracle paving the way for his canonization has been identified and confirmed in France. Don Giuseppe, or Pino, as his nickname, Puglisi, was murdered by the mafia on his 56th birthday out in front of his church in Palermo, Sicily, in 1993. 3 years earlier, he had arrived to his own childhood neighborhood as pastor, and without much support from the archdiocese, which was corrupt and in cahoots with the mafia, he began to fight against the way the mafia would corrupt most of his parishioners into silence and get young men to drop out of school and begin to rob, deal drugs, and distribute other illegal substances. His behavior made him a marked man. While parishioners were celebrating his birthday in front of the church, he was killed with a single bullet at point-blank range. One of his assassins later confessed to the crime and said that his last words were, "I've been expecting you." John Paul II called him a courageous exponent of the gospel, and Pope Francis an exemplary priest and martyr. He was beatified last May 25th. To speak to us about these two martyrs of ordinary pastoral work, I'm very happy to welcome back to the seminar Father Raymond D'Souza, pastor of Sacred Heart of Mary Parish on Wolfe Island in the Archdiocese of Kingston, Ontario, chaplain at Queen's College, where he teaches in the economics department, editor-in-chief of Convivium, columnist for the National Post and scores of other Catholic publications, consultant to the U.S. Bishop on religious freedom, regular television analyst on things Catholic and more. But besides that, he's bored out of his mind and he does nothing, so he's able to write about this. So please join me in welcoming Father Ray D'Souza.
Thank you, Roger. Thanks, Fathers, for enduring in the afternoon. 5 out of 6. This is 5 out of 6. So, this morning in the meditation, Father David told the story about the graduation. Was it Mother Teresa? And said that, you know, some presume to speak and some have earned the right to speak. And I was looking at the schedule, and so in Walter Chiswick, we had the postulator of the cause. He's earned his right to speak. And then on Alvaro del Portillo, we had someone lived with him. And then John Phelan, the successor of Patrick Peyton. And then Christopher, he wrote his dissertation on John Paul. So they've all earned their right to speak. I'm just presuming to speak about these two priests. I have no progression. I'm a journalist, really, at heart, columnist, which means that I just need to have 800 words of expertise on any subject. But that's only about 3 minutes speaking, so the rest of the talk could be a bit dodgy. anyway, it's good to be back here. It's my third year. I came in 2012 for the first time. Roger invited me, and I know we're friends for many years. So, but I was a real experience of priestly friendship. And, you know, last year I brought Brian from Augsburg, is a friend of mine. This year he brought Joseph, so it's nice that there's this development of priestly friendships in Easter week. And I was delighted to hear Christopher, and we lived across the hall from each other in the seminary, and I loved it. I really did. I loved having Christopher over there. I'd go over there and talk to him. We had a lot of fun, I thought. But he didn't. The enjoyment of the relationship was asymmetrical. I really enjoyed having Chris there. He did not enjoy having me there. So I was pleased that he actually told a very positive story, how I made a good influence and really witnessed hope. Actually, it's not true, because this is not the first time he's done it. He invited me. He's now he's a very important person in the Diocese of Providence here now. So he invited me to give their priest convocation last November, so we had a lot of fun at that. But aside from that, I'm pleased that this talk follows the other one, follows the John Paul II one, because these two martyrs we're going to talk about are really John Paul's martyrs in a very direct sense. So what Christopher talked about, especially in Salvifici Dolores, is a good introduction. By the way, I think Jay Hughes was mentioning this. Jay keeps vigilant attention on the internet at all times of the Catholic news. So you're saying that the Wall Street Journal, Chris mentioned about George Weigel's, the seven souls of John. The ten soul profiles of John Paul, Mary and Carmelite, Dramatic, etc. Anyway, he did a short version of that in the Wall Street Journal. So this morning, was it?
I think it's this morning,
So anyway, if you want to read the short version of that lecture, it's in the Wall Street Journal this morning. What I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about these lives. They're not, they're quite easy to summarize, because the extraordinary part of the life of Father Jerzy Papaluszko was maybe 4 years. And the extraordinary part of the life of Don Pino Puglisi was about 3.5 years. So it's not, don't take a long time to speak about them, but I'll speak about them, and then I want to talk about their lessons for parish priests. The reason when Roger first talked about the seminar back in the fall, I proposed these two. First of all, they're not very well known. I was delighted at lunch, Father Jeffrey, asked me, he said at lunch, he said, does anybody hear about these two guys we're hearing about this afternoon? Does anybody know anything about them? And I said, well, I do. So I'm happy to hear that, because I want to introduce you to these important figures. They're also important because of the six figures we're looking at, or seven, I guess, with my two, the rest of them aren't really, they can inspire us, but the life of Walter Chizik, maybe his later life, is applicable to some of what we do, but not his life in Russia. Alvaro del Portillo, none of us are going to be called to be sort of a vicar of a new, global movement. Maybe not none of us, but anyway, not yet. Two of them are popes. That's a sort of distinctive way of living your priesthood. and then Patrick Peyton, who had a most extraordinary priestly life. But as parish priests, and maybe Brian understood him, a parish priest, but also a chaplain on campus, a lot of the life of Father Jerzy and Don Pino is applicable to us. A lot of what they did, we do. Now, obviously their martyrdoms set them apart, but much of their daily life would not be altogether different. They didn't spend most of their time leading great public sort of campaigns, that was part of, that's what they got known for, because they were killed. But a lot of what they did, they were both parish priests. Don Pino was a pastor of a parish, and Father Jerzy was not a pastor. He was sort of not even a vicar, but he was kind of in residence, and he had other responsibilities. So I want to go through their lives, talk a bit about that, and then the lessons as parish priests. I'm going to try and be a bit provocative towards the end, because I think the saints should provoke us. And we don't have I saw we had two bishops here last night, but they're not here today, so we're free to speak. I thought it was great we had two bishops here, but they only stayed for the first talk. Was that
because they were classmates of this?
Oh, it was an act of personal friendship. Okay, that's good. Anyway, so the last part of the talk, when we get to the lessons for parish priests, it will be maybe a little bit provocative. That's just my take on what we can learn from them, and that's proposed, but it's entirely free to disagree. And at the end, at the very end, I want to talk about how these two, who are very they're John Paul's martyrs in the sense that not only did they get martyred during his pontificate, but they were, both of them, he was a cause of their martyrdom, a direct cause, which is to say that if he had not been pope and known he didn't, they would still be alive. And so, in a very direct way, they were killed because of his ministry, which must have put some burden on him. But then I'm very concerned at the moment that, you know, in my way of mind, I write a lot about the about John Paul and his pontificate and about the Holy See and the Vatican and so forth. And in my way of thinking, taking a bit of a side, I think he really had a 35-year pontificate, right, in two acts, the longer act, the first act under John Paul, and then the sort of the second act, and like an afterword or an epilogue under Benedict. And they were really, I think, understood best as one single act, especially because Benedict was there for, you know, 20-plus years at John Paul's side. And now that's over, you know, a year and a bit, and now we have Francis. And so this is the real transition, I think. You know, Benedict taking over, you know, right from the beginning of his pontificate, he said, I don't need to do many of the things that we did under John Paul. He didn't say we, he said John Paul, but they did it together. And of course, he devoted himself quite heroically to other things like writing 3 volumes on Jesus of Nazareth and so forth. But now we really are in the post-John Paul phase as of, you know, the resignation, renunciation of Benedict last year. And so I'm worried because I think that a lot of what John Paul did is at risk, you know, being forgotten, even though he was... You know, we live in a world that's so novel-centric that, you know, he's 8 years... I'm a university chaplain, so my students now, when John Paul died, they were 10 years old, right? So it's already in the past. And to anticipate where I'm going to end up, you know, there's so much of what John Paul did, you know, it was so vast, but, you know, I was glad Christopher mentioned, you know, talk about Laborum Exercens and Salvifici Dolores. You know, John Paul did sort of trilogies on big things, right? So, for example, he had his trilogy on the Trinity, Redemptor Hominis Divis and Misericordia Dominum et Vivificantem from 79 to 86. Then he had the trilogy of social executables, Laborum Exercens, Solicitudo Rei Socialis, and then Centesimus Sanus. There are many things in threes, but one of the things in my kind of taxonomy of John Paul's work is that in those first 5 years he did sort of an anthropological trilogy on human sexuality, so what it means to be created male and female, theology of the body, what it means to suffer, which is part of the human condition, which Christopher talked about in Salvifici Dolores, and then what it means to work, which is another essential part of human life in Laborum Exercens. And on all those three things at the moment, even though they're quite relevant to some of the themes the Holy Father is highlighting, you don't hear about them. Right? This discussion that is going on in anticipation of the Synod. Roger wrote an article recently on Cardinal Caffaro, who's an expert in theology of the body. He said he was flabbergasted that this discussion is going on without any reference to theology of the body. The Holy Father, current one, Pope Francis, has very much in his heart the burden of unemployment, which is, I think, admirable. But when he speaks about it, the rich sort of personalistic concept of work in the Laborum Exercens is nowhere to be found. And Salvifici Dolores, I think, has always been, you know, despite the good work of Christopher, you know, somewhat neglected. So anyway, I think that in that sense, these two martyrs also give us a bit of a, can serve as a bit of a correction to some things I'm worried about. But again, that's me. I mean, that's, you can take or leave that. But let's first do some history of these two figures, Father Jerzy Papouszko and Father Pino Puglisi. Just for your own, if you're interested in these figures, in the handout there you'll see there's a website. This is the parish of St. Stanislaus Kostka, where Papouszko, there's the website there, and it's in English and in Polish. And it's very good, a lot of information there on his life, his history, so you can check that. And then there's this DVD. This is Papouszko, Freedom is Within Us. It's a Polish film, and so it's English subtitle. So it's a bit, if you're a multitasking type who likes to sort of watch films and listen to them while doing something else, you can't, because you have to have to watch, unless you speak Polish. But it's very good. It's worth watching because it really gives you a sense of his day-to-day life. Like you see him in his apartment and people coming in and out and all the chaos of it. And sort of the raggedness of the life that you know, he was subjected to. So I'd recommend that. I think this is I'm not sure, Ignatius or wherever. Yeah, it's Ignatius. So that's easy enough to get. I couldn't find any books to show you, fathers, in English on Don Pino Puglisi. Maybe they're out there, but I could not find them. So I'll leave these here, not for you to take, but if you want to look at them. This is a biography by the postulator, Padre Pino Puglisi Beato. This is a hilarious book. This is Pino Puglisi, priest and martyr. It's one of the collections of these, collections of papers at the theological conference. If you've ever been to a Italian theological conference, I find them hilarious because, you know, you get these long papers. There's one point. You get 7 pages, make one point. Then the next one comes, other 7 pages, one point. So you get 100 pages to read to get 2 points out of the whole list. it's there. This one, The Priest Who Sowed the Hope. That's a basic biography. This is even funnier. This is what you, when you order books online, you spend $18 on a book that consists of pages like that. 100 phrases from Don Pino. There we are. Anyway, they're there. I'll quote from some of them during the talk. Okay. But while I'm at it, this is the magazine Roger talked about, Convivium. It's like a Canadian First Things, although it's not as scholarly. This is the current issue, this is the one previous. I left those two copies on the table there. I'll leave these there afterwards. Please don't take them because I didn't bring one out for anybody, but you can look through it, and if you're interested, you can subscribe to it. But I'm going to reference this at the end because in this current issue, I do an essay on John Paul and John the 23rd and their different pastoral approaches. And I think these two martyrs show John Paul's pastoral approach, which is not John the 23rd's pastoral approach. Honor both saints, and you can venerate both saints, but they don't have the same pastoral approach, and I think Francis wants to take us back more in the direction of John the 23rd, and if you're a John Paul priest like myself, and you admire these martyrs, that's a challenge, because that's not the way I would be inclined to go. Anyway, that's the outline of what we're going to do. So Father Yerzhi was born, Triumph of the Cross, 14th September 1947, and martyred 19th October 84, so he was in his 30s when he was martyred, younger than many of us here. And he grew up in a rural Polish Catholic family, but in the Warsaw, not in the Warsaw Diocese, sorry, but he joined the Warsaw Diocese. He'd gone to Warsaw. By the 1960s, when he entered, Cardinal Brzezinski was out of prison. They had worked out an arrangement between the church and the state about how the church was going to live under communism, and so the seminaries were open, were functioning. He was in the seminary, but seminarians had to go do military service. They had a special kind of military service for seminarians. They'd be in special brigades and so forth, or whatever you call them. So he did that, and then he was ordained. Interestingly enough, I'm always fascinated by dates and things like that. He was ordained on the 28th of May 1972 by Cardinal Brzezinski, the primate of the millennium. It's very interesting in this film, by the way, if you watch the film, if you know Polish history, 20th century Polish history, the way they talk. Because even though in the critical years of Yerzhi's life, 80 to 84, Brzezinski died in 81, when they talk about the cardinal, when they talk about the primate, they're talking about Brzezinski, the primate of the millennium, one of the most important figures, well, the most important figure in Polish history of the 20th century after John Paul. But interesting, Brzezinski died 28th of May 1981. So if, which I'm sure one day he'll be beatified, he's one of the great heroes of the church of the 20th century, his feast day would be presumably the day that he, Father Yerzhi would be ordained on the feast day. Anyway, that's just, I think, interesting. He was not a strong or impressive personality physically or intellectually. Socially, he was, by accounts, he was sort of, one of the group, but not particularly strong physically. So he spent most of the 70s, after he was ordained in 1972, in sort of moderate assignments. He'd be in an assignment, he'd get sick, there'd be something else for him to do. There were so many priests in Poland then that there was, there was lots of room for people who were having a difficulty to kind of, be alternately assigned. But interesting enough how Providence works, he got to know the world of medicine very well because he was in hospital and around the clinic. So when John Paul made his epic pilgrimage to Poland in 1979, he was appointed coordinator of medical services. Like I said, that first aid, tents and all that kind of stuff for this huge visit. So he was actually in charge of that aspect of the visit, which turned out to be important because it introduced him to a lot of people, and he got to know how to organize and logistics and make contact and all that, which in the martial law period, of course, was all the more valuable. So in 1980, he was finally assigned to St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, which is in the district of Warsaw that was probably one of the more leftist districts, one of the districts where there was a kind of Bohemian intellectual life, and so maybe Marxism would have been a little bit more acceptable, but for the most part, it was a Polish parish with all the Polish resistance to the restrictions on the church. He came there in 1980, so the year after, not within the year, calendar within the 12 months of John Paul's pilgrimage in 79. And of course, 1980, what became Solidarity, the first strikes broke out in Gdansk. And then they spread, you know, throughout the country. They got to Warsaw in August of 1980, a few days after, a few weeks maybe after Gdansk. And one of the demands, you remember the pictures, if you saw them, of the Gdansk shipyards, was that, you know, they had the pictures of the Holy Father, the pictures of the Black Madonna on the gates. They had priests coming to say Mass, priests coming to hear confession. So it was a religious event in addition to a social protest and a union event or labor event. So it came to Warsaw, and the workers, seeing what was going on in Gdansk, asked, because they were kind of occupying. What they were doing, they were kind of it was an odd kind of strike. Like, when we think of a strike, we refer to go to work. They were actually, the workers were kind of occupying the plant, but not working. So one of the things they asked for was, could we have priests for the pastoral care? So they asked Brzezinski to send a priest to say Mass for them on whatever that Sunday would be, the 31st of August. So Brzezinski said, yes, send the priest, and he just gave it to his secretary to, you know, find someone. And the secretary went to this parish, St. Stanislaus Kostka. I don't know why. Maybe it was physically proximate. And they were very excited because the communist shipyards, were a symbol of the communist state, the state enterprise, state, you know, control. And to have a mass said there was a big deal. So they were excited, but interestingly enough, Lord knows how many priests in St. Stanislaus Parish. But they're all busy. One had a baptism, one had a mass to say, one had, who knows, one was doing altar boy practice, I don't know, whatever it was. And so Father Yerzy was free. So even though he wasn't the most senior priest there, he wasn't the most, I think he said, well, he's free, so he went. And it changed his life, because he arrived at the shipyards and they opened the gate for him and they were applauding, and there's one of the autobiographical accounts, he said, I was looking behind me to see who were they clapping for. Because he was just not even a parochial vicar, right? And in Poland, where you got priests, you know, falling off the trees, he was nothing. And then he realized, okay, they were so excited because the priest was with them. They were clapping for him. They were so keen to have, in the person of the priest, the church with them in the yards. So he offered that mass, and then he went back. And so basically from 80 onwards, he became a sort of de facto chaplain. He lived at this parish, St. Stanislaus Kostka, and he was sort of on the staff. It's hard for us to imagine, because this is a parish that might have had, you know, 8 or 9 priests who were there. So there was all kinds of things to do. He didn't actually live in the actual rectory. I don't know why. Maybe there wasn't room or whatever. He had an apartment close by. But he was belonged to that parish, but he mostly spent his time in doing all kinds of assistance to the workers, becoming kind of a de facto chaplain to Solidarność in Warsaw. And he provided for their sacramental needs, but also their material needs, educational needs, cultural needs. He would organize on Saturdays for seminars, people could learn about Polish history, but also, you know, technical topics, scientific topics, so to increase their sort of general culture. And then material needs, especially after martial law. Martial law starts in December of 1981, and so people are in prison, their families are now without a breadwinner, and he does a lot of practical needs, getting people what they need in terms of material goods. And then also, you know, going to court to sit in the courtroom when there are trials going on, to show his support for those who are being prosecuted by the communist state. So he's involved intensely in all this work to support the workers and, more broadly, all those people who are resisting the regime and need cultural, material, spiritual, educational resources. And he's not alone in that. There are many priests and parishes around Poland doing it. The home parish of Lech Walesa in Gdansk was one, I think called St. Bridget's, was one that was also doing this. So he was not remarkable in that sense, you know. And in a certain way, he was a bit of a free agent in that he saw a problem, he'd go there and try and fix it. And they were very intense, practical problems. He's being imprisoned, or he's being charged. There's no food, there's no clothes here. You know, it was not the sort of a life where he was articulating a sort of intellectual critique of the anthropological foundations of Marxism. That was not the work that he was doing. And that's really how he spent those 4 years, with one exception, which set him apart. So in February of 1981, the parish priest of St. Stanislaus, and some of the fathers who were older will remember, it's like, you know, in Boston, for these old sort of parishes with eight priests and the grand monsignor who ran everything, that was sort of how it was, right? So he was not just the parish priest, he was the leading figure in that, you know, neighborhood, and he was, by all accounts, a very admirable man. And he started these masses for the homeland in February of 81. So this is before the assassination attempt, before the martial law period, so about 6 months after Solidarity began. One Sunday, I think the last Sunday of each month. And he said them. They were not Father Jerzy's men. The pastor said it. And these continued. Then December 81, martial law comes. So now Poland is in a state of war with its own government. And this is one of the most remarkable things. So Father Boguchki decides that he's going to hand these masses over to Father Jerzy, who's the kind of the junior priest there, because he has seen something in him, in his preaching, in his connection with the workers. He says, this is actually the man to do these masses. And so he starts these monthly masses for the homeland, and he'd preach these fiery anti-communist sermons. And there'd be 10,000 people. Now, obviously, maybe 600 or 800 in the church. It's not that big a church. And they'd be out in the streets every month. And what was remarkable about those was that I think Timothy Garton Ash called it the Peace of Free Poland. It was the only place in the entire Soviet Empire where on a regular basis someone would stand up and criticize the government. The only place. Lech Walesa was not allowed to speak in public. He'd just been released from prison after martial law or internal house arrest. But it was the only place this was being done. So 10,000 people would come to listen to this. Well, this is what made Father Jerzy, Father Jerzy, these monthly masses. Now, the other 29 days of the month, he would be doing all these practical things to help people. But as the fame grew, he'd be invited to come and give talks, give retreats, and so forth. So he did certain traveling around, you know, preach missions and so forth in the in other parts of Poland. And he earned, for that reason, the ire of the secret police. There was a moment in his apartment. His apartment was part of the complex, and he wasn't sort of on his own. It was sort of part of the complex of the parish. And some kind of low-level explosive was thrown through his window. So, you know, everybody came, you know, running. And he was okay. And there's a scene in the film, I presume true to life, where he says, you know, I can't do it anymore. It's too exhausting. I'm too tired. I can't do it. And this pastor who had chosen him, this pastor obviously saw in him something more. And in the film, it's great, he says to him, stop pitying yourself.
Stop what?
Stop pitying yourself. No. Bomb is just going through the window. He says, stop pitying yourself, you're a man of God. So you've got, it was a sort of also an act of faith, that God is with us in this. So he had the support of his pastor. He did not have the support of Cardinal Glemp, who is the successor to Cardinal Wyszynski. Cardinal Glemp was in an impossible position. He becomes primate in 1981. Martial law is declared, so now he's the primate, where the Polish government's at war with its own people. He's the new Archbishop of Warsaw, and he's just succeeded the greatest Archbishop of Warsaw in the thousand-year history of Poland. So, you know, he's out of luck. It's not going to work. And he didn't know what to do. I'm not sure if Wyszynski would have known what to do, but he probably would have, because he was Cardinal Wyszynski. So you know, he's got this priest who's causing trouble. I mean, he supported Father. I mean, it wasn't like he disagreed with what Father Hiroshi was saying, but he didn't know what to do with it. So he was circumspect, but he certainly didn't stop it. But occasionally, you know, Father Hiroshi would get the sense that, you know, if he was to be a little bit more restrained, that would be appreciated. But Cardinal Glenn did not stop it, although he was very nervous about it because, you know, they were under martial law. Martial law was lifted in July of 1983, but the persecution did not stop. And then finally in 1984, the regime moved against Father Hiroshi and they started interrogating him. So there were, and it was publicly known, and he was summoned for interrogations. The movie has some hilarious scenes where they show how the pastor and the bishop are sort of fobbing off the secret police, you know, and they bring the summons and subpoena and so forth. But eventually he goes and he's interrogated in these sessions. Everybody knew they were going on and they'd wait outside for him. And but it went on for about 6 months till July of 1984. And then by that time, a year after martial law, there was a sort of agreed amnesty because to figure out, you know, how they're going to reconstruct Polish society. So he was never tried. But they'd already decided that the secret police, or some of the secret police, had decided that this problem needed to be solved more definitively. And so in October of 1984, he was killed in a very brutal fashion. They're put in the basement of St. Stanislaus Kostka Museum of Father Hiroshi. It's very well done in English and Polish. And the scene where they show the body, they show the pictures of the body when they found him. They found him. It was actually miraculous they found him because they tied him up, they beat him to death. They tied him up, they threw him in the water with concrete blocks so he'd never be discovered. And somehow, after 9 days, maybe 11 days, I think October 30th, so 11 days, the body somehow surfaced. And meanwhile, at St. Stanislaus Kostka, for those 11 days, they had masses 24 hours a day, you know, waiting for news of, and then he died. They found he was dead. And they show the pictures of it, which is just, I mean, you can almost barely make out that it's him. Well, you wouldn't unless you were told it was him. So it was a brutal killing. And then his funeral was on the 3rd of November. He would have been buried in the priest cemetery, or the priest part of the local cemetery. Big delegation, like a petition of something like 20,000 signatures, was made to Cardinal Glemp to bury him in the churchyard, which before the internet is pretty impressive in 2 days. And so Cardinal Glemp was leery of this whole thing, but he gave permission, and he's buried, which is a beautiful shrine there. If you go there, John Paul visited in 1987. And the funeral was astonishing. It was 250,000 people in the streets, you know, Polish episcopate. Walesa was allowed for the first time at his funeral to speak in public after martial law. So. And he came from Gdansk during the time of Father Hiroshi's abduction to plead for nonviolence because he knew that there was a moment that everything could unravel. And then from that moment, that shrine of his grave has been, you know, a place of pilgrimage. And he was the great hero of Saul. He was the voice of John Paul in between the visits, if you want to say, you know, between the visits. And the decree for his martyrdom came, and he was beatified on the 6th of June 2010, and in one of the most moving things you could possibly imagine, his mother, at the vigil the night before the beatification, his mother led the rosary. Imagine that for your own son. And then she carried the relics.
Wow.
I don't think it's ever happened before in the history of the Christian. You know, the mother carrying the relics of a martyr. His father's deceased, but his mother is still alive, or maybe just died. But anyway, you can imagine that mother carrying the relics of her own martyred son. So, I mean, there is something deeply, you know, romantic and dramatic about the Polish experience, and then here's another chapter of it. And his feast day is 19th of October, the day he was killed. So, Father Pino Puglisi, there's a link there. There's an article in English written, I'm actually very proud. It's written by the Krakow seminar that George Weigel and Richard Neuhaus and Michael Novak started many years ago. I went on it when I was a student. I teach on it now, and he's one of our students, Philip. And he wrote this article. There's very little in English about him, but anyway, that's a basic introduction, just an article, but you can find it there in the other books. his life very ordinary, except for one stubborn act of courage. He didn't like the mafia. He's born on the Feast of Our Lady of Sorrows, 1937, in Brancaccio. This is a poor neighborhood in Palermo. And he was martyred on the 15th of September, as Roger mentioned, his birthday. He had a conventional religious, you know, Southern Italian religious upbringing. He was in the seminary at the age of 16, ordained in 1960 for Palermo. Had for about 10 years various assignments, nothing remarkable. The assignments a new priest would get, you know, assistant in various parishes. He began to speak about the mafia, but he wasn't a pastor, so he, you know, he wasn't. There's nothing remarkable about him. He didn't have any prominent role. He was frustrated. In the 1960s, the cardinal of Palermo was Ernesto Ruffini. Ruffini, I don't know his first name, Ernesto. And he belonged to the old order, which was that there was a way of life in Sicily, and the church had its place, and the government had its place, and the mafia had its place. And Cardinal Ruffini famously said, he said, there's no such thing as the mafia.
That's right.
He said, there's no such thing as the mafia.
Okay.
He retired or died in 1967. There's another cardinal for a couple of years, and then Cardinal Salvatore Pappalardo. He was Archbishop of Palermo from 1970 to 1996, a long time, 26 years. And he began to shift. Well, Sicily began to shift. But in the 1970s, when he became pastor, that is, Polizzi became pastor of this parish in Gargano, he began to lead that shift in Sicilian conscience. He began to speak out against the mafia, which was not done. Not by government, not by the church, not by the judges. It just wasn't done. He started. Now, he was not alone. There was a shift going on in the church, in life in Sicily. But he was at the lead of that. So occasionally throughout the 70s, when he was a pastor there, he would be at odds in his vocal criticism with his brother priests and with the archbishop. But he was not punished for that. I mean, it wasn't like he was silenced for it or anything like that. Because 1978, he was given important roles in the seminary. He was made rector of the minor seminary in Palermo. He was the director of diocesan vocations. Any vocations directors here, aside from Brian? The patron. He taught mathematics and religion in various schools. And he was sort of a chaplain animator to various things. He seemed to be involved in a lot of different, you know, movements and associations. And, you know, doing days of recollection and so forth. So for 12 years he had the life of a priest who had some diocesan responsibilities, you know, the minor seminary vocations, then would do other things around the diocese. So by no means was he certainly he was a more vocal critic than others, but and maybe people didn't like it, but he wasn't sort of sent away for this, And he was in the forefront in the late 80s and into the 90s. Sicilian society changed, and the church was part of that. So you find Cardinal Pappalardo, speaking out against the mafia more directly. And then, of course, the huge anti-mafia trials in Sicily of the late 80s. Hundreds of mafiosi were sent to jail. Effort by Italian magistrates, and there was a brutal resistance to that, and the assassination of judges. If you remember, in the late 80s, early 90s, they started assassinating judges, which was, you know, another escalation. So, for example, I think the most famous judge who was assassinated was Falcone, who the airport in Palermo is now named after. Falcone was assassinated in 1992, and at the funeral of Falcone, Pappalardo, the Cardinal Archbishop, says this, and so this shows you the shift that's going on. Now this is 1992. You know, he says, "Is it possible?" I'm translating it for the time, so it may not be good English, but Is it possible to count amongst the true Christians, count them, the mafiosi, among the true Christians, even if they have received baptism? Do they bring honor to the name that they carry, or do they dishonor it? Do they deserve to be part of the community of the children of the sons of God? Or do they not really make, are they not really part of it, but rather through their actions, do they belong to the, it says here, della sinagoga di Satana. And then in brackets it says, poi credete in chiesa. So it's the party of Satan. It's not a Jewish thing, but anyway. They're less sensitive to anti-Semitism in Sicily than the other parts of the world in terms of language. So you see there's a shift going on, right? So now the church is, I mean, and Pino was in the forefront of that. But now, you know, but now they're killing judges. So Sicilian society has turned. And there's a very beautiful quotation actually from another young judge. He was called the Magistrato Giovane. He was his name is Rosario Libatino. He looks like he's about 30 or 28, this young judge. He was also assassinated. And in the introduction to this book written by Cardinal Romano, the actual archbishop, there's a note from his diary. He says, at the end of life, we will not be asked if we were believers, but whether we were credible witnesses. Credenti, not, we won't be asked if we're believers, but credibile. Are we men of integrity? Do we show the integrity of what we believe? So this is going on in the early 90s in Sicily. And Don Pino is now sent in 1990, 29th, to St. Michael, to St. Gaetano's parish in Brancaccio. So he's back now in the parish he grew up in. It's still a poor neighborhood. It's run, the mafia in that area is run by the Graviano brothers. And it's a very mafia-infiltrated parish. There's not a lot of economic opportunities, and so the mafia can give status and prestige and money and so forth to the young people. So it's a big problem in his parish. He's back in his home parish, and he starts to speak out. So he's there in 1990. Now, in the 1970s, when he first started to speak against the mafia, he would be largely alone. By the 1990s, he was no longer alone. Sicilian society had changed. There was this massive prosecution. The cardinal was speaking against the mafia, whereas his predecessor denied it existed. So things had changed, but he's still in the forefront. And now he's fighting it, not as a matter of the church should be opposed to organized crime, but how practically do we combat the mafia in my parish? So he starts speaking out against them. He refuses them to have the position that the mafia, the capos, the capi would usually march at the head of the Corpus Christi procession. He didn't allow that in his parish. He didn't take money for parish works from the mafia, which had been customary. And then he preached against them quite regularly and quite with a lot of ferocity. And he became famous for what they call the quattro parole, the four words. Say, ognuno fa qualcosa, which I think you can translate, if someone did something, everybody complains that we're this mafia-ridden society, everybody keeps silent, everybody cooperates, what if someone did something? So that, and apparently, I've never been to Sicily, but apparently in this neighborhood where you go, this say, ognuno fa qualcosa is graffiti all over the neighborhood. Right? And then the second part of it is, allora si può fare molto. If someone did something, then, we could do a lot, right? If someone did something. So that became his rallying cry. And then he also started, amongst other things, the flagship of his project was this youth center, which is called the Our Father, Padre Nostro Youth Center. And just to give you a sense, this is one of the little biographies of the kinds of things he did. So he said that he was the... while he was in the Diocesan Vocation Center, which he was the director, he was active in summer camps for young people, for coordinating volunteers, for gospel cenacles, I guess gospel Bible studies, in the formation of youth who were trying to be priests. When he was pastor in Godrano and Brancaccio, he did all those sort of things. But then he also started this youth center, precisely to provide jobs and direction and even recreation for young people, so they didn't have to go to the mafia because they had something else. So if you think of that, he's very much, that's the kind of thing parish priests are doing. He's running programs. He's operating a youth center. You can imagine what a headache that would have been, right? To all the, you know, the logistical matters of that. And that became the heart of his work. So he's there 3 years, you know, almost to the day in that parish, 1990, September he came. He preaches, and he organizes practical things. Now this earned him the ire of the mafia, but, you know, he was largely unmolested in his work. He was often criticized. He'd often get calls, you know, telling me, you better stop that. You know, threats, which are, you know, part of mafia life. But for the most part, he was able to do his work in that parish and to speak freely and to organize the practical aspects of his work. And in Sicilian society, to act against the clergy, I mean, there have been priests killed by the mafia before, but it was worse than killing a judge. Right? So in a certain sense, he was protected by his work. Anyway, that changed in May of 1993. In May of 1993, John Paul made a visit to Sicily, and he decided, because remember in 1992 when Judge Falcone was assassinated, it was a huge story in Italy. I mean, it was, you know, it was not a small thing. I mean, the whole country's political class was rocked by the fact that they had killed a judge, and the chief prosecuting judge in, because in Italy the judges prosecute. The chief prosecutor in Sicily against the mafia was killed. So this was a complete, you know, act of defiance. Who was going to be in charge of Sicily, of Italy? So it was a massive public issue in Italy. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there was all kinds of investigations into the role of mafia in politics and so forth. Especially after the collapse of communism, the whole sort of incestuous relationship between the Christian Democratic Party and the mafia and all these sort of things were being examined. So it was really a top-line prominent issue in Italian political life. So when the Pope went to Sicily in 1993 in May, it wasn't from nothing he was going to speak about this, because this was the number one issue in Sicily. They killed the judge a year before. So John Paul gave this homily. It's very famous. You can see there many videos on YouTube and so forth at Agrigento, I think. And he denounced the mafia, and he gave that famous homily, shaking with rage, and he said that you must convert, and one day you will be accountable. Those who have done this will one day be accountable to God. And what he said was not that, nothing remarkable about the words. They don't, you know, you wouldn't put them on a holy card or you wouldn't make a study of them, but it was the impact. He was there in person. He was, you know, sometimes, as John Paul did, he would be filled with righteous indignation when he preached, and that was an occasion. So it created a huge stir all over Italy. Pope had gone to Sicily and denounced the mafia. And so the response came that summer in July. He was there to see May. So in July, the mafia bombed the Cathedral of Rome, the Lateran. The portico in the back, so not when you face it from the front, but the kind of entrance to the back where the baptistry is, but they bombed the Cathedral of Rome, which shows that the mafia may not follow the gospel in its fullness. But they know about the difference between a cathedral and a big church and so forth. They chose. They also bombed the San Giorgio in Volabro, and I've forgotten why they bombed that church, but they bombed those two churches. That was in July in response to what the Holy Father said in May. And then on the 15th of September, as Roger mentioned in the introduction, Don Pino was in his parish. And he was out. I don't know if it was. It was his birthday, so there may have been a festivity. But he's coming back to where he lived, and these four men stopped him. And he thought initially he was a bit anxious. He thought it was a robbery. They're coming to rob him. And then he realized who they were. I don't know if you know them by name, but he realized that they're from the mafia. And that's when he gave the account that was given by the assassin. Eventually, when he was convicted, he gave this smile, and he said, "I've been waiting for you." And they shot him. That also rocked Sicily, that the most prominent anti-mafia priest had been assassinated. It took some time, but there was an enormous pressure to convict the men who did it. There were four men involved. Two of them were eventually convicted, and then they turned, and then there are dozens and dozens of convictions, including the Graviano brothers who ordered the assassination. But these two men, one of them was a very devout Catholic, had a complete conversion. Another one said for his whole life he's been haunted by the smile of Pino Puglisi before he killed him. So there's some very beautiful moments around that. And then on the 25th of May last year, he was beatified. They're building a church in the neighborhood named after him, and it was firebombed, I think, last fall. So the violence is not passed entirely. So what are the lessons from these two priests that I think can apply to us? I've got seven or eight points there. One is that they were immersed in the mundane. That's why the film is so great. I mean, you see him trying to find the bread for people and trying to find shoes for people to wear and trying to find the lawyer to accompany someone to trials in Warsaw. They were immersed in the mundane things. And you can imagine what starting a youth center is. If any of you have a youth group, let alone start a youth center, let alone one that's supposed to be anti-mafia, you can imagine, you know, that, you know, Don Pino gets calls that, you know, the pipes aren't working or been sabotaged or whatever, right? So they were immersed in these mundane things. There are not a lot of images in their lives, when you read of it, where you see them, you know, preaching a lovely meditation on the Blessed Mother for the Nativity of Our Lady. You just don't see that. And not, they may have done it, but they were immersed in this kind of this relentless, grinding, mundane task of helping people resist communism, resist the secret police, or resist the mafia. So many things that we do as parish priests are in these mundane things that are hard sometimes to see their relationship, you know, to spiritual realities. But they were immersed in it. And I'd add to that, what you see both of these priests is that the majority of their time and the majority of their friends and their closest collaborators and advisors, supporters, were lay people. Right? In the film, it comes up because you can watch it, is Father Yurishi is mostly with other lay people. I mean, he's with the other priests, but actually that's not his common ambiance. And Don Pino was also mostly with lay people. And even in a way that, you know, could be, if you want to say, imprudent, but, you know, the saints are always a little bit imprudent, I suppose, but, you know, like, you know, you'd have a meeting in Father Yurishi's apartment at, you know, midnight, and there's, you know, eight people there, and they're trying to sort of organize their, you know, response to a certain thing, or, you know, Don Pino's apartment is a kind of a gathering place for, you know, the people, young people who are, you know, otherwise, you may not say, you know, you wouldn't normally have them in your rectory and so forth, but they were immersed in the mundane, and their principal collaborators and supporters were lay people, which I think is a very good lesson for us, because that's mostly what we do. Second, they were men of action. Now, they were prayerful. They said their prayers. But you don't get an impression when you read about them of moments of... you get men of action, not men of piety. I'm not saying that they weren't pious. But that's their... and they worked long hours, and you get the sense, I'm not making judgment, as it were, but you get the sense that there are days in these two priests' lives where from the moment they got up to the moment they went to bed, they were engaged in some immediate crisis that probably meant that they didn't make their meditation that day. They didn't do a holy hour that day. I'm not advising that as a model. But I'm saying that in parish work, you can sometimes feel like that. There are days where everything, it just seems that the moment you get up, you know, there's just something the whole day. And now they had, you know, they were fighting against the principalities and powers in a very direct way. But I think that it's encouraging that they lived very much those same challenges, you know. I put activist without activism because Father Yurishi had a very intense sacramental life. He did a lot of, you know, mission, you know, preaching, Eucharistic preaching, confessions, and so forth. So I don't want to separate those two out, but you do get very much a sense from them that they were activists. They were men of action. That was their gift, that they could get things done, and I think that can be very consoling to us who often face the same thing. they have, I'm referring to as a holy distance from the bishop. I'm not sure what an unholy distance from the bishop. I'll tell you a funny story. When I was in my first year, after my first year in theology in Rome, we went on a trip to Zimbabwe with Catholic Relief Services, and we visited this mission that was actually linked with the Diocese of Toledo in Ohio, and they provided a priest for this parish, whatever. And so we're there, and I was with the three or four seminarians were being with the priest who's there, and one of my classmates, Matthew Buning. You remember Matthew Buning? He's about as innocent and pious and, you know, naive as you can imagine. And so we asked the father, missionary, he says, "What's the best thing about being a missionary?" And he's expecting some, you know, answer about, you know, bringing souls to meet the Blessed Mother or something like that. And he says, "Oh, the bishop's 15,000 miles from here." Which was very disillusioning to the seminarians. You know, we were seminarians. We didn't know. But he knew. And look, it's not easy to be in the back country of Zimbabwe. So the type of priest who ends up there looking after the people probably has a slightly different kind of makeup. In both cases, if Father Yerzy had gone to see Cardinal Glenn and said, "In principle, Eminence, would you prefer that I do this or not?" he would have been told no. If Don Pino had gone in the 1970s, certainly 1960s, to Cardinal Ruffini, or the 1970s, probably in the 70s anyway, to Cardinal Pappalardo, and said, "Do you think I should, you know, make an initiative?" almost certainly he'd have been told no. Now, they weren't disobedient because they didn't go and ask. They didn't. Now, the bishops were aware of what they were doing. It was not secret, and they were convinced that the gospel demanded it. But I really believe, I mean, and this is, fathers may disagree, but I do believe that that the charism of the bishop is different than the priests work with him. But there are things that bishops can't do because they have broader responsibilities. Whereas individual priests, you're not responsible for the church in Palermo. You know, Pino was not responsible for the church in Palermo. The cardinal was, which with all the complexity and the mixing of the weeds and the wheat that goes on there. So they kept a distance from that. They did not present themselves as, "I am the face of the church for solidarity." Father Yerzy said, "I'm just looking after, you know, my part of the flock." But they kept a distance. Holy distance, I think, from the bishop. And I think for the most part, and you can find this in the writings of Cardinal Ratzinger before he became Pope, about, you know, the charism, how the Spirit works in the church and works in the ways to stir up new things and also works to the authority of the church. It works in two ways, and the two things sometimes don't always move in exact harmony. So, I admire them for that now, because, you know, in my own experience, I've had three archbishops I've served under. The middle one, was not an unmitigated success, our relationship. I don't think it was a problem, you know, that the work I was doing wasn't entirely in line with what he wanted. And with the current archbishop, he seems pleased with what I'm doing, but I sort of do it, you know, in addition to what I'm assigned to do, independent of his direct instructions. And I don't think that's a problem. I think actually a lot of good work in the church is, you know, stirred up in the creative and energetic work of priests looking at the circumstances around them. And if the bishop smiles on it, great. If he chooses not to look at it, that's okay. If he frowns at it but doesn't stop it, that's maybe not ideal, but that's sometimes the reality. And a lot of parish priests go through that. You know, it could be a dispute about some mundane thing, it could be a dispute about something more. And these two martyrs, I think, teach us that part of being a parish priest is the difficulty of that relationship. And it's not always God's will, this is my view, that you and your bishop be in absolute 100%, you know, agreement on approach and so forth. I mean, obviously, I would add to that that there's a vow of obedience to the bishop. If you're defying him, that's not God's will for you. But it's possible to have a kind of a holy distance there. And I think you find it in these two martyrs. But we can discuss that if you'd like. Related to that is they worked outside their formal assignments. It was not Don Pino's job to start the youth center. He was the pastor of the parish, and he could have well, in good conscience, said, I'm looking after this parish, I'm doing the best I can. Starting a youth center to combat the temptations of the mafia was a massive project that, because of the limited number of hours in the day, must have taken him away from something else. You can't just start a youth center sort of on the, you know, in your spare time. So he had his formal assignment to be the parish of pastor of this parish. For the years he had his formal assignments, it was a little bit less demanding. But they saw needs and they addressed them to the extent that they thought was appropriate without being assigned directly. And this, I think, is very relevant for us because, in, like, for example, in my diocese or in Canada in general, a lot of tasks that used to be done by religious orders, religious priests, we had all kinds of Catholic institutions. We used to have Catholic religious orders publish magazines. They're not around anymore. They don't do it. So, you know, if you see an opportunity and you have the capacity to address it, you know, it's not part. I mean, no bishop would ask you to do it. He's not going to lay that burden on us. But if you see a need and you can do it, and then you have to make a judgment about how do you sort of balance it with your assigned responsibilities. That's a challenge a lot of us face. I mean, Christopher was talking about being given form, or, you know, being one responsibility added to another. But in addition to those, it can also be you see the need for something and you want to address it, but it's not part of your assigned responsibility. Can you do something about it? That's an increasing reality, and I think these two priests give us a good, they could be intercessors and models. They're also relentlessly practical and concrete in their works. They led people to God. They led them to pray. They led them to live their sufferings in a Christian understanding, in a Christian spirit. But they did not leave them with prayerful good wishes. You know, there was a problem. You're unemployed. You've been fired from your job because you're an activist with Solidarity. Your children have been thrown out of the school because of you protested the government. You've been asked to join the local mafia gang because you don't have any money. You need a job so you can turn them down and have something practical. They didn't leave them with prayerful good wishes. Very practical. It's a reminder that the church has, the church's response has to be spiritual, but also incarnational. It has to be sometimes a practical response. One of the theological dimensions of both of these works, but especially in a lot of the writing about Pino Puglisi, was the idea that interior conversion has to manifest itself in exterior works. And this gets down to why they're martyrs, which we'll talk about in a minute. But the idea that they led their people to say that if you are interiorly converted to Christ, that has to change how you live. And that's a challenge for us, right? Because a lot of our people are quite content, as it were, to have a relationship with Christ as long as it doesn't change too much of their lives. Now, these were dramatic circumstances because they were saying this interior conversion has to lead you to take a stand that could cost you something against the communist state or against the local mafia. But that lesson is applicable. It's that they were very good at teaching their people that an interior conversion, adhesion to Christ, meant a practical consequence in their exterior works. And then they were courageous. They were very courageous. They were very demanding of themselves, and they were demanding of their parishioners and the wider circles they moved in. They're asking people to do things that were very difficult. They're asking people to do things that could put themselves in danger. And so they were very demanding, and maybe because of that they got a response. Very moving. On the night of his capture, so Father Yerzhi was in Warsaw, he'd been driven to a neighboring city, and he was leading a preaching there, and I think it was a benediction he was preaching at. And so the night he was captured on the way back from it. He was preaching before the Blessed Sacrament, and he was speaking about the need to be free from a desire from vengeance and retaliation, which he preached about all the time. But he was not. He didn't sort of give pious words about we have to get along. He said we've been injured, we've been treated unjustly, but we cannot give in to vengeance. But he quoted Cardinal Wyszynski, which he quoted often, And he said, we need the gift of fortitude. And he quoted Cardinal Brzezinski. This is the last time he preached in public. He said, woe to any country, this is Cardinal Brzezinski, which is not governed by courage. And one of the great dynamics of Father Gerson's preaching was that the resistors were the courageous ones and the powerful communists were the cowards. That was one of his themes of preaching. And then they had, both of them, an intense parochial focus. You know, they were national figures, or at least in terms of a Sicily-wide figure, a national figure in the case of Father Yerzy. They were important national figures, and they had a national ministry, as it were, but they were intensely focused on the charge that they were given, and through that served the entire nation. I mean, Don Pino was concerned about the young people in his parish, trying to give them more options than just the mafia. But because of that, he became significant all the way throughout Sicily and throughout Italy. Okay, so that's my lessons for parish priests. There can be other lessons, or even contradictory ones. Importance to St. John Paul II. First of all, you know the famous coat of arms of St. John Paul II. I'm calling him saint. That's allowed, isn't it? We're almost there. You know, the M at the foot of the cross. So this is basically the image of Our Lady of Sorrows, right? So that's his stemma, his totus tuus. And these priests were born, right? Pino was born in the feast of Our Lady of Sorrows, and Yerzy on the triumph of the Holy Cross. So when he chose that motto, he probably didn't know he'd get a martyr for each part of it, or not motto, that image, from the Archbishop of Krakow. But their dates, I mean, one is born in the Exaltation of the Cross, one was born in Lady of Sorrows. That can't be coincidental, these two martyrs. And then their feast days. So John Paul's is October 22nd, that's his inauguration day. Yerzy is the 19th of October, because that's the day he was killed. And so Pino Palicis is the 21st.
Oh my gosh.
Now, it's because he was killed on his birthday, it was the 15th of September, so they didn't want to give him that feast day because it would never be observed, Our Lady of Sorrows. So this is his baptismal day, 21st of October. Mm. So as you can make a little triduum in your parishes. Papa Yushko, Pino, Pope. Wow. If you want to do that. I don't know what's on October 20th. Roger, can you tell me immediately what October 20th is?
It's empty.
Okay.
It's really modernized.
Okay. So, anyway, that's fascinating to me. I love dates and things. And so you can prepare for the Feast of John Paul with the two martyrs preparing the way. Now, what I think his significance is here is that John Paul is the Pope of Mercy, right? At the funeral, Cardinal Ratzinger said that what defined John Paul was the teaching that divine mercy is the limitation that evil puts in the world. The limitation on evil in the world is divine mercy. But it's a reminder that mercy is not soft. Pino and Yerzy were fighting, you know. Now, were the instruments of mercy? They were instruments of mercy because they were working for reconciliation. But the first act of being a reconciliation for Polish society and Sicilian society meant confronting the evil that was there. So, John Paul is the Pope of Mercy. There's no doubt about it. But it has to be understood that his understanding of mercy was not a kind of softness, which can be a corruption idea that mercy is just being indulgent. You know, no matter who you're being indulgent. Of course, that's not a Christian idea, but we see it around a bit. And I think, you know, if you look at the year 93, 94, 95, which is when Pino was assassinated in response to John Paul's visit to Sicily, we're in the 20th anniversary of 1994, which I think is one of the most emblematic years of John Paul's long pontificate. That was the year it was the year of the family, remember, that the UN declared. He wrote the Letter to Families, which was basically like another apostolic exhortation, a massive, I don't know how long it is, Roger, but it's a whole treatise on the family. In February of that year, he led the battle against the Clinton administration at the Cairo conference that year. He personally suffered that year. That's when he fell and broke his hip. He had to cancel his trip to the United States. Crossing the Threshold of Hope came out that year, you know, 1994. And at the end of it, he was named Times Man of the Year. Mm. And it's interesting, there are three times the Post was named Man of the Year, 1962, John the 23rd, in recognition of the Second Vatican Council and its opening to the world, and 2013, they chose Francis, basically for Who Am I to Judge? And the sort of idea of a new approach that the church would take to contested public questions. John Paul was chosen actually in a year in which he led a battle, principally against the Clinton administration at the over the course of the spring and the summer. And you could get a preview of that in 1993 with what he did in Sicily. He went into battle in Sicily and ended up in the martyrdom of Father Puglisi. And at the end of that period, in 1995, of course, comes the Evangelium Vitae, which is not, I mean, that's a clarion call for a full defense of the gospel of life and proclamation of the gospel of life against all the evils that are sort of, you know, plaguing us. So actually, I think that time of that, that 93, 94, 95 is a very important time in the life of John Paul. Let me just finish up with a pastoral approach. I put here deliberately provocative John the 23rd versus John Paul II, not because they're battling each other, but there's an essay, it's in this issue here actually. And I'm trying to ask the question, why did Pope Francis decide to accelerate the canonization? As you know, John 23rd's cause was not ready for canonization, so he had to waive the requirement for a miracle. And then he decided to canonize him along with John Paul II. So why did he do that? What's the reason for that? I mean, the precedence we have is, you know, in 2000, when John Paul, he beatified Pius IX at the same time as John the 23rd, the idea is, okay, a lot of people don't like Pius IX. A lot of people like John the 23rd. Do them together, everybody gets, you know, something. When they're beatified, beatification.
2000.
And then Benedict did it again, a little less prominently, when he signed the Decree for the Heroic Virtues of Pius the 12th, which, as you know, is not not without controversy. So he signed the Decree for Pius the 12th the same day he signed the Decree for John Paul II. So when you do two together, it seems you do it to balance. And so my reading, which is explained in this essay, which you can look at, is that I think Francis, Holy Father, finds something in the John Paul's pastoral approach needing to be balanced by what he thinks of John 23rd. And we've had some interesting reports. There's a report recently about in the one of the cardinals who was in the conclave of 2005 said that Cardinal Bergoglio in 2005, who got some votes in the conclave, had said to him, so this is a second-hand report, that had he been elected, he'd have called himself John the 24th, because John was his total inspiration. And so there's a difference. So I'm just going to, you know, the great speech of John the 23rd at the beginning of the Council Gaudet Mater Ecclesiae, which is so significant, the Church gave it as feast day. His feast day is the day of that speech now, October the 11th, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And in that speech he says, often errors vanish as quickly as they arise like fog before the sun. The Church has already always opposed these errors. Frequently she has condemned them with the greatest severity. Nowadays, however, the spouse of Christ prefers to make use of the medicine of mercy rather than that of severity. She considers that she meets the needs of the present day by demonstrating the validity of her teaching rather than by condemnation. That's John the 23rd, soon to be canonized, St. John the 23rd. It sounds very much like Pope Francis. That I don't think that Father Puglisi and Father Papuszko would have thought that the errors of the day were vanishing like fog before the sun. They were engaged in a titanic battle that cost them their lives. Both are required, obviously. You can't say that the Church's pastoral approach should only be in one track or the other. But I think John Paul, I mean, John Paul is the one who talked, you start off by being unafraid. You're going into battle, as it were. He gave us the phrase civilized culture of death. He wrote Evangelium Vitae. He was fearless in his denunciations of communism ending, in this case, in Sicily. And these martyrs are martyrs for his, not just of his time, but of his pastoral approach. He could have stopped Father Yerzy. If he'd sent word from Rome, that he said, this is too provocative, we don't need to go that road. Stop 5 years, he would have been told to stop. The one person he was most concerned about, you see it in the film, was what does John Paul think of what I'm doing? And one of the bishops came back from his visit to Rome, and he said to Father Yershi, he said, the Holy Father reads your homily. Father Yershi goes white. And he said, what did he say about them? He said, he didn't say anything. He said, just give Father Yershi this rosary. Right? If Father Yershi had been told to stop, he wouldn't have been dead. He would have been 66 years old working as a pastor in Warsaw. So John Paul supported that approach. Highly combative. Father Yershi preached, as it were, a hard mercy. Maybe not a medicinal mercy. Maybe a hard mercy is medicinal mercy. But you understand the point I'm trying to make. And he died because of it. And Father Pino, all the more, if John Paul had gone to Sicily and not given the denunciation that he did, if he had not gone to Sicily, or if he had gone and not said what he did, and I'm sure there were those who were advising him not to say it, the Lateran would not have been bombed, San Giorgio would not have been bombed, and Father Pino would not have been killed. Now, so they were martyrs, I think glorious martyrs, for not just a truth of the faith, or not just the virtues required by the faith, but for a particular pastoral approach. That's my argument. And so I think, because I think that I think John Paul is the figure sent to the church in our time, and his pastoral approach and his intuition and his courage and all of that needs to be preserved and enlivened, not just his holiness, which we're going to celebrate on Sunday, because that's what I believe. I think these are two martyrs who are martyrs of his pastoral approach. And so I think in order for that to be preserved, as if I say my sense of what the church needs, which obviously is fallible, I'm very excited about them. Precisely as sort of preparing the idea in October for the first feast of St. John Paul II. All right, I've gone over time, but...
We've got about 10 minutes for questions.
Finished. John?
Do they technically need miracles since they died martyrs' death?
Not for beatification. You need miracles for... If you're declared a martyr, you don't need a miracle for beatification. Needed a miracle for canonization. So Yershi did not need a miracle for beatification. The cardinal in Warsaw, forgot his name. Which? Anyway, he announced last fall that they found a miracle for the canonization. I don't know about Puglisi. That being said, interestingly enough, the Pope can move someone to canonization without a miracle. There are two ways of doing it. One is what the Holy Father did with John the 23rd, just waived the requirement. But there will be a canonization form ceremony. The other way, you just sign the decree, and all of a sudden the person is a saint. And John Paul, I think, did it once, and Benedict did it once, and Francis has done it 6 times in 1 year. So who knows? Yeah. Including 2 Canadians, by the way, Francois de Laval and Marie de l'Incarnation. So we got 2 saints in April from the Holy Father. So who knows what the? But they don't. But they would need a miracle for canonization.
Remember the Pope Francis did condemn the mafia only a couple of weeks ago, saying that if they don't change, they'll go to hell.
Yes, well, on 2 occasions. One was last year, in the anticipation of this beatification. He was already Pope by the time he's beatified, so there were some comments in that regard. And then what you're referring to is he visited the... there's a parish in Rome that has a particular apostolate, anti-mafia apostolate, so he was there on that occasion. He said he condemned the mafia. I mean, now it's quite, it's not remarkable, but in 1993 it was still remarkable, because Italian society changed a lot. Basically, during the Cold War, there was an agreed arrangement that there was the communists, who were the principal threat to Italian public life, and the mafia were not communist. So to the extent that they got implicated in the public life of Italy, it could be tolerated or even encouraged and led to all kinds of corruption. But by 1993, that was the 80s, it was beginning to change. And in that sense, Don Pino was very courageous, because he was identifying an evil, and not against people who were saying it wasn't evil, but they were saying, you know, you got to see the bigger picture. And he was saying, well, actually, the bigger picture is that this is antithetical to the gospel.
That continued an agreement in Sicily during the war, where the mafia was not the Nazis and the fascists, and the mafia helped the overthrow of the Nazis, and also the dock workers in New York, and et cetera, the certain mafia influence, and they were told to cooperate. And
so they did.
Filling up
the boats. Well, that area of complicity, it's not just an Italian story in Italy, it's sort of different parts around the world. Anyway, other matters? Yes?
Could you just say a little bit more about your distinction between hard mercy and soft mercy, and how that relates to Pope Francis?
I didn't really say anything about Pope Francis on that, but I mean, John Paul is the Pope of Mercy, and that's what he brought divine mercy to the Church Universal. He declared the feast. He died on the feast. Canonized Faustina. The extraordinary thing about the funeral homily of Cardinal Ratzinger, who lived at his side for 20 years and knew everything he had done as Pope, the only thing he quoted out of that massive, Chris was talking about the massive amount of teaching John Paul did, the only thing he quoted in that homily's funeral was this line from Memory and Identity, which is not the most, it's a collection of talks, interviews he gave 10 years earlier, it was published, and Ratzinger said John Paul says, the limit to evil, the limit that God puts on evil in the world is divine mercy. And Ratzinger said, the funeral homily, that's the summation of John Paul's pontificate. Now, what I'm saying, I'm not talking about Francis, I'm talking about John Paul, is that, but that mercy is, I'd say, a hard mercy in that it begins by putting a limit to evil, partly by putting a limit, insisting on a limit. And if, in the common sense of the word mercy, if you look at the life of Father Yerzy and the life of Father Pino Puglisi, they didn't look to be merciful figures because they were in battle. They didn't look to be merciful figures. But they were agents of divine mercy in that they were saying there has to be a limit to this evil. Now the second stage after the limit of the evil, maybe different stages, is then reconciliation. And that might look... maybe soft and hard is not good words, but that might look softer because reconciliation is the setting aside of differences, or at least the setting aside of grievances, or overcoming of them. But that first stage, God, you can call it hard mercy, when you say, this is evil and it has to stop. I didn't refer to, I was talking about John Paul, but in relation to Francis, Francis speaks about mercy a lot. I don't think I think he would accept, I don't know if he would accept, but that you also have to stop evil. Francis is, he emphasizes mercy not just in his language, but in his actions, his gestures, in his priority of confession, where he goes, he always hears confession. But at the same time, he can be quite forceful about speaking about, evils to be stopped. Or, for example, if the meeting we had with priests at the beginning of Lent with the priests of Rome, and he said, look, I said, a lot of you are calling me and saying, why am I so hard on the priests? Why am I bastari, right? Beating up on the priests. He says, well, I don't, he said, it's kind of funny, he said, I don't intend to do that today. but he knows, right, that correcting, he does a lot of correction. He corrects all the time in his remarks. I think he must see that, given that the priority of mercy in his pastoral approach, if he's always correcting, he must see that as part of mercy. Otherwise, he'd be in conflict with himself, which I don't think he is. So that might be the harder edge. Is that satisfactory?
Yeah.
Soft and hard may not be a good way, but I just use those words. But
just on that point, he's had 6 daily mass homilies over the last year in which he's made the distinction between being a sinner, and then the term he uses is being corrupt. A sinner is someone who recognizes a sinner and comes to mercy. A corrupt just steps on the gas. So that's his distinction in his terms.
So you can be more soft with the sinners and hard with the corrupt, maybe. Okay.
So on that line also, with the soft mercy, these two models, will be also the pastoral view of Pope Francis, because he was involved a lot as a bishop and cardinal in what they call the Villas, priests who were working with I mean, very difficult realities. If other priests were constantly being targeted, you know, mm-hmm. and in fact there was one that, you know, have been, you know, talk about being kidnapped or killed, and he himself, Francis, the Rolio, said, I should be the one being, you know, that need to be killed.
Yeah, because I sent him.
Right,
yeah.
He has said that.
Yeah,
so,
that
and even the government, I mean, this came up later in his book, I think, or interview, 17 times he wanted to meet with the president and he was never invited. And you know that after he was elected Pope 3 times there already. So the humility, I think, that he doesn't hold grudges or for the government, and they have said that he was the number one enemy of the government at the time of Argentina, so I think, I mean, the soft mercy, I mean, the pastoral approach of these two priests, I think, very much rely, because Francis was...
Well, I think that in the Villas, Miserias in Argentina, Don Pino would be a very good model. I mean, they're not, it's not exactly the same, but there are drug cartels, there are that dimension of organized crime. You know, actually for those, I mean, right here in the United States, for priests who work in areas that have gangs, as a challenge to the youth, you know, Don Pino would be a good model and intercessor.
Thanks, Raymond.
All right.